the only daughter of a respected political family. Karen's father, Mitch, had once been a White House chief of staff. Karen was also beautiful, intelligent, and kind. She adored Jack unconditionally. The two of them had spoke often about starting a family together one day, when Karen finished grad school and Jack's congressional schedule got less hectic. Evidently, one day was now. Fred Farrell frowned.
I'm not so sure Karen's the best choice. She's a sweet girl and all, but for your wife...
Jack bristled. What's wrong with her?
There's nothing wrong with her. Don't take it personally, Jack. I'm merely saying that ideally I'd prefer someone with a little more wow factor. Not too pretty, of course. That's a big turnoff for your base.
But prettier than Karen?
Higher profile than Karen. It wouldn't hurt if she were independently wealthy, too.
Why?
For the future, dear boy.
Fred Farrell shook his head despairingly.
I'm assuming your political ambitions don't end with the Senate.
Of course not.
Good. Then start thinking practically. Have you any idea how much a presidential run costs these days?
Jack had a pretty good idea. Many a wealthy man had lost everything pursuing his White House fantasies. Even so, marrying for money seemed distasteful.
Look, I have a girl in mind. Meet her, see what you think. No pressure.
3 months later, Congressman Jack Warner got over his distaste and married society heiress Honor Knowles in a blaze of publicity. The day they left for their honeymoon, Karen Connolly committed suicide, slitting her wrists in the bathtub. Out of respect for Karen's father, the press never ran the story. For Honor Knowles, her whirlwind romance with the most eligible, dashing congressman in the country was easily the most exciting thing that had ever happened to her. Ever since she was a little girl, Honor had felt overlooked. Her elder sister Constance was the brains of the family, and their mother's clear favorite. Grace, Honor's younger sister, was drop-dead beautiful and had been the apple of their father's eye when he was alive. All of which left Honor pretty much nowhere. The fact she was bright and attractive in her own right didn't seem to matter to anyone. I'm the fifth wheel, the backup singer no one ever notices. I'm only popular by association. For a handsome man to single her out, and not just any handsome man, but Jack Warner, a possible future president, was so thrilling, so deliciously unexpected, that it never occurred to Honor to question Jack's motives, or the speed with which he hustled her down the aisle. Jack, she soon learned, did everything at speed. No sooner had he asked her out on a date than he proposed. No sooner had she accepted than he'd booked the church. No sooner had they got him back from honeymoon than he was on her case about getting pregnant.
What's the rush?
Honor laughed, stroking his sleek blonde head in bed one night. She still had to pinch herself sometimes when she woke up next to Jack. He was so perfect. Not just perfect looking, but perfect on the inside, too. Noble, courageous, visionary. He wanted so many good things for America.
We've only been married 5 minutes. Can't we just enjoy being together for a little while first?
But Jack was insistent. He wanted a family, and he wanted it now. On their honeymoon in Tahiti, Honor had been worried. Jack got a phone call from home on their first morning at the resort that had clearly upset him. He canceled their snorkeling trip.
You go. I have to work.
And barely spoke to Honor for the remainder of the day. That night, he kept calling out Karen in his sleep. When Honor questioned him the next day, he was defensive.
Jesus, Honor, you're cross-examining my dreams now?
After that, he was withdrawn and morose the entire week, refusing to talk about what was troubling him and avoiding all of Honor's attempts at closeness. He didn't even want to make love. But when they got back to New York, to Honor's immense relief, the black mood lifted. Suddenly, he was all over her again.
He wouldn't want to start a family if he didn't love me, she reasoned. This is his way of saying sorry for Tahiti. And really, why should we wait? What could be sweeter than having a mini Jack running around?
Their first daughter, Roberta, was born 9 months later, followed within a year by her sister, Rose. Because the pregnancies were so close together, Honor was still carrying weight from Roberta when she conceived Rose. And as a result, when Jack took her out for dinner to celebrate their second anniversary, Honor was almost 50 pounds heavier than she had been on her wedding day.
"Why don't you start running again?"
Jack suggested bluntly over the pan-fried scallops.
"You could go with your sister and her trainer. Grace is looking fantastic at the moment. The guy must be doing something right."
It was as if he'd stuck a pin in Honor's eyeball. Grace. Why did everything always have to come back to Grace? When Honor married Jack Warner, she felt like the star of the show for the first time in her life. Growing up, Grace had always stolen her thunder. The worst part was, she'd done it without even trying. Just by walking into a room, Grace owned it, shining with a light so blinding it obliterated Honor's presence altogether. Honor tried hard to stamp down her feelings of jealousy and resentment. She knew Grace loved her, that she thought of Honor as her best friend, and yet there were times when Honor Knowles fantasized about her sister having an accident. She pictured Grace falling from the high bars, her perfect little doll's body contorted and broken on the gym floor. Or a car accident, in which Grace's exquisite model features were ravaged by flames, the flames of my hatred. The fantasies were shameful, but they felt good. When Honor married Jack, she thought, "All that's behind me now. Now that I'm happy and famous, now that someone wonderful loves me, I can be the big sister Grace had always wanted me to be." It didn't work out that way. Ironically, it was Honor who had introduced Grace to Lenny Brookstein at one of Jack's fundraisers. 2 weeks later, Grace announced they were in love. At first, Honor thought she was kidding. When she realized her mistake, she felt sick to her stomach.
"But Gracie, you're 18 years old. He's old enough to be your grandfather."
"I know. It's crazy,"
Grace laughed, that sweet, tinkling laugh that made all men melt like butter on a stove.
"I never thought I could feel this way about someone like Lenny, but I'm so happy, Honor, truly. And so's Lenny. Can't you be happy for us?"
"Darling, I am happy, if it's what you really want."
But Honor wasn't happy. She was furious. It wasn't enough for Grace to settle down with some normal, rich investment banker like Connie had done. Oh, no! Madam has to go and ensnare the biggest billionaire in New York. Honor Knowles' brief moment in the sun was already fading. While she was stuck at home, fat and exhausted like a mother hen, Grace was once more the talk of the town. And now here was Jack, her own beloved husband, comparing her unfavorably to her sister because she'd gained a few pounds giving birth to his children. It was not to be borne. And yet Honor did bear it, stoically and in silence. The same way she bore Jack's neglect of her and the children, his selfishness, his rampant ambition, and most recently, his infidelities. She lost the weight, every last pound of it. As far as the public was concerned, Senator Warner and his wife had a fairy tale marriage. Honor was not about to disillusion them. The pretense was all she had left, and she kept it up, smiling at Jack loyally during his speeches, giving magazine interviews about her homemaking tips and Jack's brilliance as a hands-on father. Of course, Honor knew full well that the only thing Jack had his hands on lately were the au pair's breasts, but she would have died rather than admit it. The same went for her loathing of her sister. On the surface, Honor Warner remained close to both her sisters, but particularly to Grace. The two women ate lunch together twice a week, in addition to their regular shopping trips and vacations en famille. But beneath the loving, sisterly facade, Honor's resentment bubbled like scalding magma. Jack encouraged his wife to strengthen her ties to the Brooksteins.
"It's win-win, darling. You get to spend time with Grace. I know how much you'll love her. And I get some face time with Lenny. If Lenny Brookstein endorses my run for the White House in 4 years' time, I'll be unstoppable."
Honor thought about it. If Jack runs for president, he'll have to stop chasing tail. It's too risky. Plus, if he becomes president with Lenny Brookstein's money, I'll be first lady. Not even Grace can trump that. Recently, however, Jack's fervor for his billionaire in-laws had inexplicably cooled. It started with bitchy comments about Grace's clothes and Lenny's ever-growing paunch. In the days leading up to the quorum ball, it spilled over into something more overt. Jack was drinking heavily. At home, when drunk, he would rant at Honor about Lenny Brookstein's disloyalty, his arrogance.
"Fucking prick, who does he think he's talking to? One of his employees?"
he rambled.
"If Lenny wants his dick sucked, he should ask John Merrivale or that ass-kisser Preston. I'm a fucking United States senator."
Honor had no idea what Jack was talking about. She longed to ask, but she was too afraid. Despite everything, Honor Warner still loved her husband. Deep down, she was convinced that if she helped Jack's career, said the right things, wore the right dress, threw the right parties, he would eventually fall in love with her again. She could not know that Jack Warner had never been in love with her in the first place. Jack came downstairs in his bathrobe, hunting for some Alka-Seltzer. Roberta, known to her parents as Bobby, flew into his arms like a whirlwind.
"Daddy!"
Blonde and chubby, like a Renaissance cherub, Bobby had always been a very affectionate child.
"Ilsa says if we're not good, we won't go to Intucket. That's not right, is it?"
Jack set his daughter back on the floor.
"Don't pester your father, Roberta," said Ilsa.
"But we like Intucket. Even Rose does, don't you, Rosie?"
4-year-old Rose was pulling Dior lipsticks out of Mommy's makeup bag and snapping them in half, rubbing waxy pink mess all over the hardwood floor. Ilsa was too busy making eyes at her to notice.
"Can I help you with anything, Senator Warner?"
"No," Jack snapped.
"Nantucket. I forgot about that. That bastard Brookstein invited us all to his estate last night, like we're all such good buddies." It had cost Jack Warner's pride dearly for him to go to Lenny Brookstein for help. He'd never have done it if he hadn't been desperate. But he was desperate, and Lenny knew it. It had started as a sort of stress relief. A few innocent bets here and there on the horses or the blackjack tables. But as his losses crept up, so did the size of Jack's positions. Gambling had unleashed a reckless side to Jack Warner that he had never been aware of before. It was exciting, exhilarating, and addictive. Recently, his addiction had started to cost him dearly in financial terms, but the real risk was political. Jack had built up his entire career on his reputation as an upstanding Christian conservative. Compulsive gambling might not be illegal, but it would lose him the family values vote in a heartbeat. Fred Farrell gave it to him straight.
You have to stop this, Jack, right now. Pay off your debts and wipe the slate clean.
As if it were that easy. Pay off my debts with what? Honor's inheritance had all been blown on the house and the children's education. As a senator, Jack earned $140,000 a year, a fraction of what he used to make as an attorney, and an even smaller fraction of what he now owed, in some cases, to some deeply unsavory characters. There was no way around it. He would have to tap his brother-in-law. It would be embarrassing, sure, but once he explained the situation, Lenny would help him out. Lenny's a long-term thinker. When they make me president, I'll pay him back 1,000-fold. He knows that. It turned out Lenny Brookstein did not know it. Instead of writing a check, he'd given Jack a lecture.
I'm sorry for you, Jack. I truly am, but I can't help. My father was a gambler. Put my poor mother through hell. If it hadn't been for the enablers, the friends who bailed him out time after time, the nightmare might have ended a lot sooner. As it was, he lost the money that could have paid for Ma's medical treatment.
Jack tried to keep his cool.
With all due respect, Lenny, I don't think I have much in common with your father. I'm a United States senator. I'm good for this money. You know that. It's just a small cash flow problem.
Lenny smiled amiably.
In which case, I'm sure you'll solve it on your own. Now, was there anything else?
Patronizing bastard. It wasn't just a refusal, it was a dismissal.
Jack Warner would not forget the slight as long as he lived. His first thought last night had been to tell Lenny Brookstein to stick his invitation to Nantucket where the moon don't shine.
But, on reflection, perhaps that was a mistake. The truth was, he was still in urgent need of a significant injection of cash. Honor and Grace were close. Maybe if Honor worked on her little sister, Grace could make her besotted husband see sense. Of course, such a policy would mean Jack coming clean to Honor about his gambling debts. Not an appealing prospect. But at the end of the day, what was she going to do? Leave me? I don't think so. Turning to Ilsa, he said,
"We'll leave for Nantucket first thing Monday morning. Please make sure the girls are packed and ready."
Bobby shot her au pair a look of purest triumph.
"See? I told you we were going."
"Yes, sir. Is there anything special you'd like me to pack?"
Ilsa gave him a lascivious wink. Her meaning could not have been clearer. Neither could Jack's.
"No, you won't be coming with us. As of Monday, you're fired."
Grabbing the Alka-Seltzer from the kitchen cupboard, he went back upstairs to bed. Chapter 4 Connie Gray stood in the playground, watching her sons on the monkey bars.
"Look at them, so innocent, they have no idea the world is crumbling around them."
Cade was 6, and the spitting image of his father, Michael. Dark-haired and olive-skinned, he had the same open, happy, guileless face as Mike. Cooper had more of Connie in him. His coloring was fairer, his features more feminine, and he was altogether a more complex child. Sensitive. Anxious. Both the boys were highly intelligent. With parents like Connie and Michael, how could they not be? But 4-year-old Cooper was the deeper thinker.
I wonder what he'd think if he knew what his mommy has been up to. Perhaps one day, when he's older, he'll understand how desperate times call for desperate measures.
The eldest of the Knoll sisters, Connie, had been a straight-A student since the first grade. Her mother's pride and joy, Connie had had to make do with her father's respect and affection. Cooper Knowles's heart was already spoken for. It belonged to his youngest daughter, Grace. Like Honor, Connie recognized early on that the baby of the family was special, a uniquely compelling, lovely child. Unlike Honor, however, Connie had no intention of taking a back seat to little Grace or of giving up the limelight. She played her roles as the brains of the family brilliantly, graduating top of her class in high school and getting accepted into all the premier Ivy League colleges. Though she feigned a lack of interest in beauty and fashion, Connie knew she was attractive, albeit in a strong-featured, masculine sort of way. She did all she could to maintain her flawless, alabaster complexion and the trim, long-legged figure that men so admired. She might not be able to compete with Grace in terms of looks, but at 8 years older, she didn't have to. By the time Grace is old enough to come out in society, I'll be happily married. She'll be Honor's problem then. And, of course, she was. Like all the Knoll sisters, Connie married for love. Michael Gray was a knockout in those days. He was still pretty gorgeous, but back then he still had his football player's physique, as well as the chiseled Armani model features that made all the secretaries at the Lehman Brothers swoon. Connie kept working as a lawyer until Cade was born. After that, there didn't seem much point. Michael was a partner at Lehman, earning millions of dollars a year in bonuses. Of course, most of that came in the form of stock options. But back then, who cared about that? Bank stocks were only moving one way. Up. If the Grays spent multiples of Mike's basic salary every year, they were only doing what everybody else was doing. If you wanted something expensive, like a Hamptons beach house, or a Bentley, or a $100,000 necklace for your wife on her anniversary, you borrowed against your stock. It was simple, tax-efficient, and one that no one questioned. Then Bear Stearns collapsed. In hindsight, the failure of that venerable old New York institution in March 2008 was the beginning of the end for Michael and Connie Gray, and for thousands like them. Of course, hindsight is 20/20. At the time, Connie remembered, it still felt as if something seismic and awful and unimaginable was happening to someone else. Those were the best kind of tragedies. The kinds that were close enough to give you a frisson of terror and excitement without actually affecting your life. It was 9 months now since the awful September day when Connie's own world had collapsed. She still woke up some mornings feeling happy and content for a few blissful seconds until she remembered. Lehman Brothers went bankrupt on September 16th, 2008. Overnight, the Grays saw their net worth drop from somewhere around $20 million to about $1 million. The equity in their heavily mortgaged New York townhouse. Then the housing market dropped through the floor, and that $1 million fell to $500,000. By Christmas, they sold everything but Connie's jewelry and pulled the kids out of school. But the real problem was not so much the financial catastrophe itself, but Connie and Michael's polar opposite responses to their predicament. Michael Gray was a good man, a trooper, and you couldn't keep a good man down. "Just think how many millions of people are worse off than we are," he would tell Connie constantly. "We're lucky. We have each other, two terrific little boys, good friends, and some savings. Plus, we're both young enough to get out of there and start earning again." Connie said, "Of course we are, darling," and kissed him.
Inside, she thought, Lucky, are you out of your mind? Connie Gray didn't want to get out of there and start earning. She didn't want to dust herself off and try again. She didn't want to pack up her troubles in her old kit bag and smile, smile, smile. And if Michael spouted one more inane fucking platitude, so help her, she would strangle him with his one remaining silk Hermes necktie. Connie had no interest in becoming of one of the Credit Crunch's stoic, plucky survivors. The American dream wasn't about surviving. It was about winning. Connie Gray wanted to be a winner. She had married a winner and he had let her down. Now she must find a new protector, someone who could provide a decent life for her and her children. The affair with Lenny Brookstein had not been planned. Affair? Who am I kidding? It was a two-night stand. Lenny made that very clear last night. Connie had always gotten along well with Grace's illustrious husband. In happier times, she and Mike would have had dinner with the Brooksteins regularly. Inevitably, it was Connie and Lenny who ended up screaming with laughter at some private joke. Grace used to tell Connie all the time, You know, it's funny. You and Lenny are so similar. You're like two peas in a pod. Whenever he talks to me about quorum and business, I have no idea what he's going on about. But you know everything. It's like you're really interested. And Connie would always wonder, how on earth did these two get married? Lenny Brookstein was brilliant and engaging, tough and ambitious, and alive. The most alive person Connie had ever met. Grace was sweet. It made no sense to Connie. But she didn't dwell on it too much. Back then, she and Michael were happy and rich, albeit in a modest way. Back then... The first time it happened was in Lenny's office, late at night. Connie had gone to see her brother-in-law privately, to talk to him about a bridge loan and the possibility of his helping Michael find another position. The Lehman MDs had become Wall Street's lepers, tainted by failure, untouchable. Michael was a good banker, but no one was prepared to give him a second chance. Connie had started to cry. Lenny put his arm around her. Before they knew it, they were on the floor, tangled in each other's arms, and Lenny was making passionate love to her. Afterward, Connie whispered, We're so alike, you and I. We both have the hunger. Michael and Grace aren't like that.
I know. Said Lenny. That's why we have to protect them. You and I can protect ourselves.
It was not the response Connie had hoped for, but she did not leave Quorum's offices that night disheartened. On the contrary, a new and interesting door had just been opened. Slipping into bed beside Michael an hour later, she wondered excitedly where it might lead. It led nowhere. 2 weeks later, Connie slept with Lenny again, this time at a cheap hotel in New Jersey. Lenny was crippled with guilt.
I can't believe we've done this. I've done this, he corrected himself. It's not your fault, Connie. You and Michael are under terrible stress, but I have no excuse.
Connie whispered huskily. You don't need an excuse, Lenny. You're not happy with Grace. I understand that. She was never right for you. Lenny's eyes widened. He looked at Connie with genuine incredulity.
Not right for me? Grace? My God, she's everything to me. I love her so much.
The sentence tailed off. He was too choked to finish it. Eventually, he said,
She must never know about this. Never. And it must never happen again. Let's put it down to a moment of madness and move on, okay?
Sure, said Connie.
if that's what you want.
Driving home to Michael, she could barely contain her rage. Move on? Move on? To what? What have I got to move on to? A life of middle-aged penury with my formerly successful husband? Living off scraps from my little sister's table? Fuck you, Lenny Brookstein. You owe me. And now you can pay me. You think I'm not gonna let you walk back into Grace's arms scot-free?
Mommy, watch me!
Cade was on the swing. He rocked his skinny legs back and forth to gain momentum, then leaped into the air, landing with a satisfied thud on the sand.
Did you see how high I went? Did you see?
I saw, honey. That was awesome.
Connie drew her finely woven summer shawl more tightly around her shoulders. Cashmere, from Scotland. It had been a birthday present from Grace. Soon, everything we own will be a present from Grace. The food on our table, the shirts on our backs. The thought of spending next week with Lenny and Grace at their magnificent beachfront estate was enough to make Connie feel nauseous, especially after her little tete-a-tete with Lenny on the dance floor at the Quorum Ball last night. The bastard had actually had the temerity to get angry with her, with her, as if she were the one who pursued him. Lenny had led her on and then dropped her like a piece of trash, scuttling back to her baby sister and their oh-so-perfect life together. And now, Connie was supposed to be grateful to have her airfare paid so she could sit in their $60 million home and watch the two of them canoodling? It was Michael who forced the issue.
I'd like to go. It was generous of Lenny to invite us, and I could use a break from New York. Some sailing, some sea air.
Michael had always liked Lenny. But that was Michael. He liked everyone. When Lenny extended the invitation last night, Mike practically bit his hand off. If he knew where Lenny Brookstein's hands have been, on my breasts, my ass, between my thighs, he might not be so quick to bite. But Michael Gray did not know. As long as Lenny Brookstein did the decent thing and gave Connie what was coming to her, he would never have to. Chapter 5. Lenny and Grace Brookstein's Nantucket estate was an idyllic, sprawling, gray-shingled mansion set just off Cliff Road on the north side of the island. The main house boasted 10-bedroom suites, an indoor swimming pool and spa, a state-of-the-art movie theater, a chef's kitchen, and an enormous gabled roof terrace, known on Nantucket as a widow's walk, because in the olden days, sailors' wives used to climb up to their rooftops and gaze out to sea, hoping to spot their husbands' long-lost ships returning. Formal gardens, planted with lavender, roses, and box hedges in the European style, cascaded down the hillside to Steps Beach, one of the quietest and most prestigious beaches on the island. At the bottom of the garden were four guest cottages, charming, wisteria-clad dollhouses in white wood, each with its own miniature front yard and white picket fence. Anywhere else the cottages would have looked impossibly twee. But here, on this magical island frozen for all time in some simpler, bygone era, they worked. At least Grace Brookstein thought so. It was she who had built and designed them, down to the very last Ralph Lauren pillowcase and antique Victorian clawfoot tub. Grace adored Nantucket. It was where she and Lenny got married, without question the happiest day of Grace's life. But it was more than that. There was a simplicity to the island that did not exist anywhere else. Of course, there was money on Nantucket. Serious money. Tiny, three-room fishermen's cottages in Sea Concert changed hand for upward of $2 million. During the summer, Michelin-starred restaurants like 21 Federal and the Summer House charged more for their lobster thermidor than George V in Paris.
Upscale boutiques on Union and Orange Streets in town showcase $1,000 cardigans in their windows. Galleries representing local artists regularly sold pieces for six figures, sometimes even seven, to the island's wealthier residents. And yet, somehow, Nantucket remained determinedly low-key. In all the years she'd been coming to the island, Grace had never seen a sports car. Billionaires and their wives strolled around town in khaki shorts and white cotton shirts from the Gap. Even the yachts in the harbor were conservative, far less flashy than the ones in East Hampton or Saint-Tropez or Palm Beach. Lenny never moored anything but a modest 47-foot bareboat in Nantucket. He would have died of shame before he showed up in the 300-foot Quorum Queen, even though in Sardinia, Grace could hardly get him off the thing. Nantucket was a place where rich people pretended to be poor, or at least poorer. It made Grace nostalgic for her childhood, for a simpler time in her life, a time of innocent pleasures. It thrilled her that Lenny loved the island just as much as she did. Other than Le Cocon, their Bastide-style retreat in Madagascar, there was nowhere else on Earth where Grace felt so totally relaxed. The Brooksteins were happy everywhere, but they were happiest of all here, in this house. Grace and Lenny arrived 3 days before their guests. Lenny still had some work to catch up on, didn't he always? And Grace needed time to talk to the staff and make sure that everything was perfect for her visitors. "Give Honor and Connie the larger two cottages because they've got kids. Andrew and Maria can have the one right on the sand, and the Merivals can go in the smallest one. Caroline's been here before, so I'm sure she won't mind." There was so much to do. Planning menus, ordering flowers, making sure the bikes and fishing rods were ready for her nephews and nieces. Grace felt like she'd barely seen Lenny. The night before the hordes descended, the two of them had a romantic dinner at Chanticleer, a pretty, intimate restaurant in the fishing village of Syokonsent. At least, it would have been romantic if Lenny hadn't spent the entire evening glued to his BlackBerry.
"Is everything all right, darling? You seem so stressed."
Grace reached across the table and squeezed his hand.
"Sorry, honey. Everything's fine. I'm just a little... there's a lot going on at the moment. Nothing for you to worry about, my angel."
Grace tried not to worry, but it was hard. Lenny never brought his work problems home with him. Never. This morning, a perfectly harmless homeless man on the wharf had asked Lenny for change, and Lenny had flown at him, lecturing him on alcoholism and taking responsibility for 10 straight minutes. Later, Grace had been picking raspberries in the garden when she overheard Lenny shouting out of their bedroom window. He was on the phone with John Merivale. Grace didn't catch everything he said, but one phrase had stuck in her mind. "They all want a piece of me, John. The bastards are all bleeding me dry. If you're right about Preston, after everything I've done for him, I'll cut his fucking hand off." What did he mean, bleeding him dry? And who were the bastards? Surely not Andrew Preston. Andrew had worked for Lenny since year one. He and Maria were practically family, like the Merivales. Grace's only comfort was that at least Lenny was talking to John. She knew he trusted him and relied on him like a brother. Whatever the problem was, Grace felt sure that John would know what to do. He'd be here tomorrow, then hopefully Lenny would feel a little more relaxed. The vacation got off to a smooth start. Once the house guests arrived, Lenny was more relaxed, quite his old self again, in fact. With the exception of Jack Warner, who still seemed out of sorts, everyone appeared happy to be there and determined to have a good time. Michael Gray appointed himself Pied Piper to all four of the children,
taking his nieces, Bobby and Rose, fishing for crabs with their cousins, and treating them all to ice creams at Jetty's Beach. Grace was delighted. Poor Mike and Connie had been through so much this past year. You could see the vacation was doing Mike good. As for Cade and little Cooper, they were in seventh heaven, outdoors all day on their bikes or up to their necks in sand. During the days, the other four men, John, Andrew, Jack, and Lenny, sailed or played golf, while their wives indulged in some serious retail therapy. Grace loved treating her sisters to little gifts. Nothing gave her more pleasure than spending her good fortune on others, especially Connie and Honor. She would happily have splurged on Caroline and Maria, but neither of them would let her. It probably feels weird for them because I'm so much younger. They think of me like a daughter. Still, Caroline especially had always been so kind. Grace was determined to find some way to show her appreciation.
"I was thinking of having a special dinner tomorrow night at home," Grace accosted Lenny in his study. She was bursting with excitement. "I'm going to ask John all of Caroline's favorite dishes, and I'll have Felicia make them. What do you think?"
Lenny looked at her fondly. "I think it's a great idea, Gracie." Grace started to walk away, but he reached out and grabbed her hand. "I love you. You know that, don't you?" She laughed and threw her arms around him.
"Of course I know it. Honestly, Lenny, what a funny thing to say."
"I'm not sitting next to her, or Lenny, and don't expect me to clap my fins together like a performing seal and bark in gratitude either. I'll leave the groveling up to you, John."
Caroline Merrivale was in a foul mood. Despite the fact that it was she who insisted they accept Lenny's invitation to Nantucket, she now blamed John for everything. The dull excursions, the dreary company, the fact that they'd been relegated to the meanest and shabbiest of the dreadful little guest houses. She refused to see Grace's special dinner as anything other than yet another patronizing slight.
"Just don't make a scene, Carol, all right? That's all I'm asking."
"All you're asking? And what do you think gives you the right to ask anything? Have you spoken to Lenny about the raise?"
John looked pained.
"Not yet. It's not as simple as you seem to think it is."
"On the contrary, John, it's very simple. Either you talk to him or I will."
"No, you can't. Please, you must leave Lenny to me."
"Fine. But you better grow some balls and talk to him before the end of this vacation. If I have to listen to his vauscious wifelet gush one more time about how grateful she is for my incredible friendship, I can't be held responsible for my actions."
John Merrivale thought sadly. "Grace is grateful for your friendship. Poor misguided girl." Lenny was a lucky man. Wives like Grace were one in a million.
"Please, don't stand on ceremony, everyone. Dig in."
Grace felt unaccountably nervous. The dinner itself looked fabulous. Felicia had excelled herself as usual. The lobster bisque smelled exquisite and was the perfect shade of pale pink. The roast lamb looked mouth-wateringly succulent on its bed of organic greens, and the raspberry pavlova was as much a sculpture as a dessert, a towering triumph of snow-white meringue and blood-red berries. Caroline couldn't fail to be delighted. And yet Grace could not enjoy her triumph. Earlier that day, she'd seen Connie talking heatedly with Lenny on the beach, then storming off close to tears. When Grace caught up with her sister and asked her what was wrong, Connie had shrugged her away angrily.
"It's Michael," Lenny explained. He's depressed. They're going through so much stress right now, honey. You mustn't take it personally.
But Grace did take it personally. Not 4 hours earlier, Honor had bitten her head off, too. All Grace did was ask if she wanted to come to the spa.
Not everything in this life can be fixed by a fucking massage, Gracie, okay? Christ, is that your answer to everything? To spend more money pampering yourself?
Grace was deeply hurt. She wasn't a materialistic person. Honor, of all people, should know that. In fairness, Honor had apologized afterward.
It's Jack. He's got so much on his mind lately. I think some of the stress is rubbing off on me.
Grace forgave her, and they made up. But still, a lingering anxiety remained. Perhaps she was imagining it, but it seemed to Grace that there was an almost palpable tension around the dinner table tonight.
They're all unhappy, even Lenny. I want to make them happy, but I can't.
The soup's ambrosial, Grace. Nice job!
Mike Gray grinned at his sister-in-law.
Thanks,
she smiled back. He doesn't look depressed to me.
Maria Preston said snidely,
Indeed, your chef is to be congratulated. He must have worked like a slave all day to produce this feast.
Andrew Preston blushed. Not even Grace Brookstein was stupid enough to miss a blatant dig like that. He wished Maria would get a grip on herself, but after a few glasses of wine, she was lethal. It was bad enough that she's insisted on coming to dinner in a lavish Roberto Cavalli evening gown, slashed to the thigh, and wildly inappropriate for the occasion.
Maria, Cara, everyone else will be in jeans or simple sundresses. You look stunning, my angel, as always, but couldn't you...
No, Andy, I couldn't. I am not everyone else. Haven't you learned this by now?
Grace was too polite to rise to Maria's bait. Lenny had no such qualms.
Our chef is a she, actually, Felicia.
His tone was measured.
And she does work hard, though I'd hardly call her a slave. Last year, I paid her considerably more than I paid your husband, Maria.
Andrew's blush deepened.
Maria glared at him in silent fury.
Grace wished the ground would open and swallow her. She hated confrontation. Lenny, on the other hand, had grown tired of walking on eggshells.
Senator Warner, he said brightly. You're awfully quiet this evening. What's the problem, Jack? Not in the party spirit?
If looks could kill, Lenny Brookstein would have dropped dead at the table.
Not really, Lenny, no. Unemployment rates in my constituency are about to reach 10%. While we're sitting around your table enjoying this fine food and wine, the people who voted for me are having their homes repossessed. They're losing their jobs, their health insurance, their hope. And they're relying on me to try to fix things for them. So, no, I'm not really in a party mood. If you'll excuse me.
Honor watched in horror as Jack got up from the table and left the room. He'd finally come clean about his gambling debts last night. As a result, Honor hadn't slept a wink. It was exhaustion that had made her lose her temper with Grace earlier, something she'd been kicking herself about all day. Not because she gave a damn about Grace's feelings, but because the entire purpose of this trip was to try to get closer to Grace so she could use her influence with Lenny to get him to clear up Jack's debts. Last night, Jack had yelled at her,
I need Lenny Brookstein. Without that money, I'm finished. Do you understand? We're finished.
Honor did understand. But now, here was Jack, storming off like a spoiled child, embarrassing them both in front of everyone.
"I better go after him," she said meekly. "Sorry, Grace. Lenny."
The dinner party limped on. After the Warrens' departure, everyone made an effort to be upbeat, but Jack and Honor's empty chairs were like two ghosts at the feast. John Merrival made a toast, thanking Grace for the meal, but his stammer got so bad halfway through that Caroline had to finish it for him. Connie left before dessert, citing a headache. By the time the maid had brought the coffee, the forced smiles of the remaining guests were beginning to look like lockjaw. In bed with Lenny afterwards, Grace broke down in tears.
It was a disaster, wasn't it? Why does everything come back to the stupid economy? Connie and Michael losing their house, Jack stressed out about unemployment.
I don't think that's all he's stressed about, sweetheart.
Even Caroline and Maria were moaning at the hairdressers about how much less John and Andrew are making this year. I hate it.
Lenny was furious. Maria and Caroline were bitching to you? Are you kidding me? They're lucky their husbands still have jobs. The SEC is all over us like lice. Grace gasped.
You're under investigation?
Don't worry, honey. It's nothing. A shitstorm in a teacup. They're looking at all the big hedge funds right now. The point is, these are tough times, and Quorum survived them because of me. Which means those ungrateful bitches' husbands have survived it because of me.
Please, darling, Grace sobbed. Don't get angry. I shouldn't have said anything. I can't take any more fighting tonight, really. I can't take it.
Lenny took her in his arms. I'm sorry, he whispered. I've been a bit of a Grinch on this trip, haven't I? Grace nestled closer to his body. She always felt safe and happy pressed against him. I'll tell you what, tomorrow morning I'll get up early and take the boat out by myself. Sailing always clears my head. By the time I come home, I'll be so relaxed you won't recognize me.
Sounds good.
Grace began drifting off to sleep. Later, she would try to remember the exact words that Lenny had said next. It was so hard to untangle dream from reality. What she thought she heard was, "Whatever happens, Gracie, I love you." But maybe she dreamed it. All she knew for sure was that she'd fallen asleep that night happy. For the last time. Chapter 6. John Merrival tightened his seatbelt and closed his eyes as the 6-seater twin-engine plane shuddered its way up through the clouds. A nervous flyer at the best of times, he was terrified of these little puddle jumpers. It was like trusting your life to a lawnmower.
"Don't worry,"
the woman next to him smiled amiably.
"It's always bumpy first thing in the morning, before the sun burns through the clouds."
John Merrival thought, "Can sun burn through clouds?" Then smiled at himself for being so philosophical today of all days. If the lawnmower didn't fail them, they would land in Boston in 25 minutes. It was 6:15 a.m. At 8:15 a.m., Andrew Preston took his seat on a different airplane. The 100-seater Fokker 100 was only 2/3 full. I guess not a lot of people fly to New York from Nantucket on a Tuesday morning. They all left yesterday. He had mixed feelings when he got the call late last night, telling him he was needed urgently back in the office. Peter Finch,
The head of the SEC investigative team, looking into the quorum's accounts, wanted some face time. Andrew dreaded the meeting. He could think of no good reason why Finch would summon him back to New York, and quite a few bad ones. On the other hand, being away from the office made him feel hideously out of control. He believed he'd covered his tracks, but these SEC bastards were like bloodhounds. In any case, he needed to get out of Nantucket. That guest cottage was starting to feel like a prison. After her public humiliation at dinner last night, Maria had flown into a hysterical fury, swearing and screaming at Andrew, even attacking him physically. Rolling up his sleeve now, he could still see the livid red scratch marks from her nails.
"How dare you allow Lenny Brookstein to treat us like that? He made a complete fool of me, and you sat by and did nothing."
Andrew fought back the urge to tell Maria that it was she who had started it, by trying to make a fool of Grace. Instead, he said, "What would you have me do? He's my boss, Maria. He pays our bills."
"Barely? He pays you less than his goddamn cook. Didn't you hear what he said? Doesn't that bother you?"
Andrew had heard. And it did bother him. He was 90% sure that Lenny was joking. If the chef was making more than he was, she was certainly overpaid. But it wasn't unheard of for Lenny's generosity to prompt some peculiar decisions. He tried to reason with himself. "Why should I care what Lenny pays somebody else? It is his money, after all. He can do what he likes with it." But it still rankled. Perhaps, on some subconscious level, it justified what Andrew had done. Maria was passed out cold when he left her this morning, exhausted from her drunken rage. When she woke up, she'd have a horrific hangover. Andrew did not want to be within 100 miles of her when that happened. Now he wouldn't have to be.
"Cabin crew, please be seated for takeoff."
Closing his eyes, Andrew Preston tried to relax. Grace met her sisters for lunch at the Cliffside Beach Club. After their awkward encounter the day before, Connie went out of her way to be solicitous to Grace, even presenting her with a beautiful guava pink seashell she discovered on the beach that morning.
"I know it's not much, but I thought it would look pretty on your dressing table."
Grace was touched. She knew how difficult Connie found apologies. The shell said more than any words. Honor asked,
"Are Caroline and Maria joining us?"
In a cream J. Crew sundress that washed her out, with her hair scraped back in a ponytail, Honor looked exhausted. Grace wondered if she and Jack had fought last night after Jack stormed out of the dining room, but was too tactful to ask.
"I don't think so. Caroline's in town looking at a painting, and Maria's still asleep, I believe."
The sisters exchanged glances.
"I wonder what she wears to bed," Connie giggled. "Spun gold Versace pajamas?"
It was a nice, light moment. Grace finally started to relax. The waitress came and took their order. They were sitting at an outdoor table right on the beach, but by the time their appetizers arrived, storm clouds had begun to gather. The manager appeared.
"Would you like to move indoors, Miss Brookstein? I have a lovely table by the window I can offer you ladies."
At that instant, a loud clap of thunder made everyone jump. Seconds later, the first heavy drops of rain began to splash on the table.
"Yes, please," said Grace, laughing.
She thought about Lenny out on the boat. "I hope he's safe and dry in the cabin, not out on deck catching his death of a cold."
It was almost 4 by the time the 3 sisters arrived home. By that time, the storm was there in full force. Michael Gray met them at the front door.
"Thank goodness you're back," he said,
hugging Connie tightly.
"We only went for lunch at the club, honey," she laughed. "Why so panicked?"
"I didn't know where you were, that's all. I thought you might have gone sailing with Jack. The conditions are awful out there."
"Jack's gone sailing?" Honor's white face turned even whiter.
"Are the girls with him?"
"No," said Michael.
"Don't worry. Bobby and Rose are playing chutes and ladders with our boys in the kitchen. They're a little bored, but other than that, they're fine."
"And Jack? Has anyone heard from him?"
"His radio's down."
Honor's knees started shaking. Jack had been an avid sailor since his teens, but a storm like this would test anybody's skill, even his.
"It's okay," said Michael. "The Coast Guard thinks they're located him. We should hear more soon. It's been crazy out there, you can imagine, but they're trying to get everybody back to harbor. Come on in out of the rain."
"What about Lenny?"
Connie and Honor had moved inside, but Grace stood frozen on the front path. Rain dripped from her hair and her tip of her nose. She looked about 12 years old. Michael Gray frowned.
"Lenny? I thought he was at the golf club. That's what he told the staff here when he left this morning."
"Because he wanted to be alone.
He didn't want you or Jack to invite yourselves along."
"No,"
Grace was shaking.
"He's on the boat."
"Did he take any crew?"
"No, I don't think so."
Michael tried to hide his concern.
"Do you have any idea where he was going, Grace? What his plans were?"
Grace shook her head.
"All right, sweetheart. Don't worry. We'll find him. Come on in and I'll call the Coast Guard. Those guys are the best. He'll be back home in no time, you'll see."
Jack Warner got to the house at 6 p.m., soaked to the skin and badly shaken.
"I've never known a storm to close in that fast. Never."
Honor hugged him. Without thinking, Jack hugged her back. Connie and Michael were upstairs, putting the children to bed. Downstairs in the kitchen, Grace, Honor, Caroline, and a still green-looking Maria Preston sat waiting for news. Lenny's yacht was still missing. John Merrivale had gotten back from his business trip in Boston half an hour earlier. Walking over to Grace, he put his arm around her, ignoring Caroline's dagger stares.
"Try not to worry. Lenny's an experienced sailor."
Grace barely registered that he'd spoken. She was too busy praying.
"I lost one father, Lord. Please don't let me lose another."
At 8:17 p.m. exactly, the phone rang. Grace pounced on it.
"Hello?"
10 seconds later, she hung up. Her teeth were chattering.
"Grace?"
Caroline Merrivale moved towards her.
"What is it? What did they say?"
"They found the boat."
A chorus of "Thank gods" and "I told you so's" echoed round the room. When they'd all stopped hugging her, Grace said softly,
"Lenny wasn't on it."
Then she passed out. Chapter 7. Later, the period after Lenny's disappearance blurred in Grace's memory into one long, unbroken nightmare. Hours became days. Days became weeks. But none of it seemed real. She was living in a trance, a hideous half-life from which only one person could awaken her. And that person was gone. After 3 days, Sea Rescue called off its search. Around the globe, the headlines screamed, "Leonard Brookstein missing, presumed dead, hedge fund genius lost at sea. New York's richest man feared drowned." Grace had never read anything so awful in her life. Had anyone told her at the time that worse was to come, she would not have believed them. How could anything be worse than life without Lenny? It was John Merrivale who brought her home to New York. Her sisters and the others had all gone back when the search was called off, but Grace couldn't bring herself to leave Nantucket.
"You can't stay entombed on the island forever, Gracie. All your friends are in the city, your family. You need a support network." "But I can't leave Lenny, John. It's like I'm abandoning him."
"Darling Grace, I know it's hard, terribly hard, but Lenny is gone. You have to accept that. No one could survive a day in those waters. It's been 2 weeks."
With her rational mind, Grace knew John was right. It was her heart she had trouble convincing. Lenny wasn't gone. He couldn't be gone. Until she saw his dead body with her own 2 eyes, she could not give up hope.
"Miracles happen. They happen all the time. Perhaps he was rescued by another fishing boat. Maybe a foreign boat. Simple people who don't know who he is. Maybe he's lost his memory or found his way to an island somewhere."
It was all nonsense, of course, voices in her head, but in those early days, Grace clung to the voices for dear life. They were all she had left of Lenny, and she wasn't prepared to give them up. Not yet. When she got back to the Park Avenue apartment, Grace found hundreds of bouquets of flowers waiting for her. She could have piled the condolence cards up to the ceiling.
"See?" said John. "Everybody loves you, Grace. Everybody wants to help."
But the cards and flowers didn't help. They were unwanted, tangible reminders that as far as the world was concerned, Lenny was dead. 3 miles away, in the FBI's New York offices, at 26 Federal Plaza, 3 men sat around a table. Peter Finch from the SEC was a short, amiable man, completely bald except for a thin tonsure of ginger hair that made him look like a monk. Normally, Finch was known for his good humor. Not today.
"What we're looking at here is the tip of the iceberg," he said grimly.
"Pretty big fucking iceberg."
Harry Bain, the FBI's assistant director in New York, shook his head in disbelief. At 42, Bain was one of the Bureau's highest flyers. Handsome, charming, and Harvard-educated with jet-black hair and piercing green eyes, Harry Bain had foiled 2 of the most significant domestic terror plots ever attempted on U.S. soil. Those had both been pretty huge cases, but if what Peter Finch was saying was true, this one could be even bigger.
"How much money are we talking about, exactly?"
Gavin Williams, another FBI agent who reported to Bain, spoke without looking up. A former SEC man himself, Williams had left the agency in disgust after the Bernie Madoff fiasco. A brilliant mathematician with higher degrees in modeling, statistics, data programming, and analysis, as a young man he had dreamed of becoming an investment banker himself, joining the J.P. Morgan training program straight out of Wharton. But Gavin Williams had never quite made it. He lacked the killer commercial instincts necessary to take him to the top, as well as the political people skills that helped his far less intellectually gifted classmates amass private fortunes in the tens of millions. Tall and wiry, with close-cropped gray hair and a military bearing, Williams was a loner, as dour and emotionless as a statue. Brilliant, he might be, but in the club